Every Tuesday, we do this.
The topics discussed here tonight are general in nature, and you should seek personal advice before acting on any of this information.
And now, on 2GB 873, The Bottom Line. Thanks to IT Financial Services. High-quality financial planning. Visit itfs.com.au.
Indeed, with that lovely little musical introduction, we have Philip Tafe and Chris Malicki here from IT Financial Services to both of you gentlemen. Very, very good morning.
Good morning.
And to you.
Nice to have you here. Of course, anyone with any financial questions, personal financial questions, anything like that in nature, give us a call, 131873. Both Philip and Chris are here to take your calls, your questions for this first hour of the program. Gentlemen, of course, a lot of discussion this week around matters to do with personal finance, particularly to do with negative gearing, capital gains tax, properties and investments. And no doubt you've had a few phone calls at the office, people just a little uneasy about where this is all heading.
No, people definitely coming out of the woodwork. I mean, the papers don't let you forget about it. Even just reading them a minute ago, I think that's front page news. So, and the difficulty at the moment, as we were talking about earlier, is that you really can't plan for what the changes are at the moment because it's all speculation. We don't know. And we have this same discussion, I guess, every year, pre-budget time, as to what might or might not be included. I would have thought anybody with negatively geared properties at the moment, you know, they're unlikely to be too badly affected if you're in the system already. And so it's probably almost the strategy would be get in while you can. It's, I guess, people who haven't got negatively geared properties who are planning for that as part of their future, you know, maybe next year or the year after, they're the people that might be missing out on some of these tax breaks going forward.
Just how much of a financial benefit on average is negative gearing to your average mum and dad, you know, property investor? How many $1,000 a year are we talking here that they can claim?
Ones that I've seen, I can get a tax deduction. There might be up to, you know, up to $10,000.
It's between, pretty good money.
Yeah, $5,000-$10,000 is kind of a normal amount of that I've seen.
Mm. And so if there were changes, of course, a lot of people would, at that level, feel a significant pinch.
Absolutely. I need to point out that negative gearing in itself, I mean, it's not a great thing. To be honest, I'd rather own a lot of properties that are positively geared and pay more tax.
Yeah, I think I heard you mention that last week.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You know, negatively geared just means that that property's costing you more than what it's making you. So while that's, I guess, if you've got a high income and you're trying to lower your tax bill, you do pay less tax if that's the case. But the end scenario everyone is aiming for, really, is for that property eventually to have its rents grow to the point where it more than covers the cost of, you know, the money that you've borrowed to buy the place. And then it becomes a positively geared property and actually adds to your, I guess, your passive income that you eventually live off one day.
How many people that you know or that maybe are clients of IT Financial Services have investment properties, but as you say, the rent is significant and they can't negatively gear it? Are there any cases of that, or can basically everybody with an investment property negatively gear?
We're in a unique situation at the moment and have been for a long time with very, very low interest rates.
Mm.
So it is possible to find properties that almost look after themselves, you know, from quite early on in the piece. But I guess anybody with some kind of forward planning would be factoring in interest rates going up at some point, and that's where, you know, eventually the cost of the borrowings, it should increase over time. And maybe then the increase in the rent that you're charging doesn't keep the same pace. And that's where you really could find yourself in a bit of a shortfall position. Mm. So I guess anybody doing their numbers based on current interest rates, that's where they need to be thinking about, but what could happen in the future, so that it all doesn't go belly up.
Yeah. I mean, Chris, there's two sides of the debate, though, isn't there, in that this whole debate around negative gearing is focused on the investor, but there is a whole other section of the economy out there that is people wanting to be first home buyers or those aspiring to get into the market, and they would say, look, anything governments can do to put downward pressure on that initial purchase price is a good thing. One of the best ways to do that, of course, is to grow the pool of properties out there so that the supply-demand ratio is beefed up. And they would say perhaps if you just limited negative gearing to new developments, that would encourage a lot more new construction. That would put downward pressure on the overall prices. To hell with the so-called investors. This is good for us as the emerging generation trying to get in.
Exactly. There's a lot. If the investment isn't as good an investment as it was because they're not getting those tax breaks of $5,000-$10,000, that means that there's going to be less investors into the pool, which should open up the market to the first home buyers. And it also could be if the investor's not getting their return off it, they could also increase, on the flip side, they could increase rents to try and get a bigger return as well. So it could work out better for the home buyers, but for the renters, it could work out worse off as well.
Very layered, very complicated.
Mm. Yeah, I would have thought, buying a new property, you get a lot of other tax benefits as well, like, you know, depreciating the value of certain fixtures and fittings. And that really isn't a benefit that first home buyers would be able to take advantage of. So I think there is some merit to, you know, incentivizing investors to get in there to see new buildings, you know, developed. I mean, you see it in Sydney now. I'm sure a lot of that money is investors, you know, speculating that this will be a good long-term investment or even a short-term one where they can, you know, build it quickly, offload it and make a profit. And if we were just relying on, I guess, you know, younger people trying to get into the market who don't have as deep pockets, you know, maybe you wouldn't get the same level of activity to create more supply of housing.
Yeah, it's a funny, I mean, overall though, I mean, Australia has a very funny relationship with property compared to comparable economies around the world. We are obsessed with owning property. Whereas you go, for example, to European economies like Germany, for example, you know, owners are maybe the very elite, the very rich in general. There's a few others, of course, that do want to buy, but in general, most people rent. Rents are basically capped in a lot of jurisdictions. Property is seen as a necessity, but not as an investment. And as a result, a lot of that capital, if people went to people like you in Germany, they'd be putting into the share market, they'd be putting into stocks or bonds, something like that. Probably you would argue a more productive use of the capital in the economy. I mean, maybe overall what we need is a big shake-up in our mindset here.
Yeah, it'd be a much more rounded investment philosophy if you had that system that you're talking about. Yeah. Because these days, yeah, absolutely, the mentality of people is to come in and say, I just want to buy as many properties as possible. And we even see it where people can't afford to do it in their own name. So they say, well, you know, can I do it in my super? Set me up a self-managed super fund, borrow money in there too. So it's almost geared up to the eyeballs just to buy property. Mm. And look, where that has benefits is, you know, property is a growth asset. It's correlated with what the share market does. And if that encourages people to, you know, invest in a big way, well, you know, if you can afford to hang on, you'll benefit from that growth over time. The problem with shares is that so many people are reluctant to invest, you know, $1 million into a share portfolio, but you'd be quite comfortable doing it with a property. So it's a great way for younger people to, you know, to get in, get on that train, benefit from economic growth in this country and hopefully rising house prices. Whereas, yeah, the share market, I think people are probably a lot more reluctant to get in and do that.
Watching the start of this year on the stock market, that's given a lot of people. I mean, obviously there are so-called buying opportunities, but not everybody has that mindset when they see it go down and down and down and down 10% roughly or 8.5% over the start of the year. Not a lot of people see that as a buying opportunity, I suppose, do they?
No, it sells a lot of newspapers, though. Putting it on the front page, stock market's lost that much.
Yeah.
Never says how much property's lost, but property does go up and down in value, but people never see it going up and down because, you know, you buy your house and then you sell it, so you don't really see a daily price of your property, and it would fluctuate just like the stock market if it did as well.
Okay, we'll take a break. When we come back, if there's people with calls, we'll go to those. 131873, of course, we're talking with Philip Tafe and Chris Maliki from IT Financial Services. They're here to answer all your personal financial questions. Take advantage of it while they're here. 131873. Talking finance in the first hour with the team from IT Financial Services. Philip Tafe and Chris Maliki are here. Back to calls in a sec. 131873 is the number. Gentlemen, the Australian stock market, you've put a few cheat notes here on the cheat sheet for me, and you're telling me that it's the best performing share market in the world. I say you're telling a fib.
Since 1900,
since 1900, right. Okay.
Long history of the share market.
Long-term view, yes. Tell me about it.
So it's actually the 15th biggest share market in the world, worth $1.2 trillion, and it was established in 1861 in Australia. So it's relatively new compared to worldwide stock exchange because the UK stock exchange, I think the first earliest was 1571 and the US was around 1792, I think, yeah. I could find out. But since 1900, after inflation, the Australian stock exchange has returned 7.5% per annum.
On average.
Year on year, yeah. So no one knows what's going to happen in the future and if it's going to continue that for the next 100 years, but, you know, it's a good indication of what's happened.
Mm. That's pretty solid return, 7.7%. Mm.
Yeah, and even if you look now, given the share market has fallen so significantly, you know, if you just bought a bundle of shares, you know, say the top 300 shares, and you can do that very, very simply on the share market by buying one of these instruments called an exchange-traded fund, the dividend that that's paying is about 5% at the moment, but then you also get those franking credits, which is the tax that the companies have already paid. So if you gross it up for that, you're looking at about a 6.6% dividend yield. That, and that's before you even factor in share prices going up themselves over time.
Better than a term deposit.
Too right. You know, I would have thought that's a pretty good return.
Well, three times better than a term deposit at the moment,
yep.
Really, isn't
yep.
it?
Yeah. Obviously, probably three times the risk as well.
Yeah.
But risk is, I guess, relative. And if you're saying that I'm buying a bundle of 300 of the biggest companies in this country, it's a pretty horrendous scenario to think that you could come anywhere near close to losing all your money. It's more, can I handle the ups and the downs along the way? And if you can and you can afford to hang on, well, then a, you know, 6.5%, you know, dividend or income each year guaranteed with no effort is a pretty good scenario. And particularly when you compare it to, you know, the property discussion that we were having, where the yields on Sydney properties might be similar to a term deposit of only 2 or 3% after you factor in all your costs.
The up and down along the way, when you talk about along the way, how long is this long-term view when you're investing in shares? What should the average... Someone came to ITFS tomorrow and said, look, you know, here's 100,000. You know, I want a good return on my shares. You would say, look, you've just got to be sensible. How long?
At least 7 to 10 years. Yeah. 7 to 10 years, I'd say. And you'd go through a few troughs, ups and downs. For the last 30 years, from 1985, if you invested $10,000 in the stock exchange, it would be worth $215,000 now. And we've had the 87 stock market crash, you know, the low through the early 90s, the GFC. It's still returned 10.8% over that 30 years. So there's always going to be something that's happening. It's going to be a crash. There's going to be booms. You just got to be patient and ride through those ups and downs.
Is it getting more volatile now, though, than it was back then? Of course, a lot more computerized trading and all this sort of thing kicking in now.
But that also creates a lot more liquidity. So, you know, in the olden days, you'd buy into a company and it could then be very difficult to offload your position without moving the price of that company quite significantly. Whereas now all this trading that you're talking about means that there's always a buyer out there and it makes it very, very easy to get in and out. And that has a, you know, a good benefit as well.
Let's take some calls. 131873 is the number. G'day, Peter.
Hi, mate. How are you?
Well, you've got the guys here.
I heard what you're talking about before, and I fit right into that category. Just to, briefly, a couple of years ago, I inherited my family home when my mother passed away, and I didn't want to live at that in that area. Well, you know, it's about 70 kilometres further out than where I want to live. So I went to a mortgage broker and asked them what should I do, and they said, "Oh, well, what you do is you get a loan based on what you've got, the property you've got, and you can cash out against that, get an offset transaction account." So I borrowed $600,000 and bought another property worth, say, about $540,000. And the idea was for the rent of my inherited property, which was $380 a week per month, was going to pay my interest only. It's worked out. I thought I could offset that. Sorry, I thought I could negative gear that. But what's happened is I'm just paying a lot of tax. I'm getting a quarterly PAYG account. I'm paying $50 extra out of my wages just to keep topping it up. Because now I find that instead of being negative gear, which I can't do because I inherited the place, I have to pay extra. My income has gone up $18,000 a year because of the income I get from the house. So and it's killing me. And the other reason is that I've got tenants in there that can't change a washer. So, you know, a toilet system goes. It costs me $250 every time something goes wrong with the place, and I sort of just want to get rid of it. Do you think I should hold on to it, or what situation?
Well, I think the situation you've described is exactly what people are hoping for with their investment properties, to be honest. You know, it's making your money, and it's creating your tax problem, which is a damn good problem to have. So... from that point of view, you know,
right.
But I guess if you really boil down the numbers, though, I'd have to see exactly, you know, what the property's worth and what the rent is that you're getting to work out. Is it actually a good investment, or could you actually do better by, I guess, you're saying, selling it and using that money for some other purpose. But I guess...
And I've got it on the market now, but I think I've missed the boat by about 3 months.
Mm.
You know, I was told if I put it on the market last September, you know, there would have been a line at the door, but now, you know, you get 3 months looking at it on Domain or something like that, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, I need help.
It sounds like, I mean, what it really opens the door for you to is to look at all those other options available to you to minimise tax. Because if property is working for you and giving you extra income, it then might allow you to be able to, can you afford to salary sacrifice to super? Can you save in other ways? Can you then use the surplus income to establish some, I guess, diversifying share portfolio? That's what it opens up the opportunities for.
Right. It's not sending me broke, but I'm not getting ahead, you know what I mean? It's sort of draining me a little bit, that's all. I don't know, I probably have to see somebody regarding, you know, what my options are, because at the moment I'm just sort of, it's a bit of a thorn in the side, and, you know, I didn't think it'd be like this. I mean, owing tax is one thing, but, I mean, I think I'm on top of it a little bit more, and, you know, they might owe me a little bit, but it's better to keep it that way, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you're welcome to call our office during the week, and we're happy to go through the specifics with you and, you know, let you know what opportunities are really available to you, because a lot of it depends upon, you know, age, and when you talk about selling the property now, what your other income is, and should you be delaying.
Yeah, well, the other thing was, I'm 54, and to buy the place I'm in now cost me $30,000 just to play ball. You know, that's the, tax
stamp duty.
So if I was to sell my place, if say I sold for $550, by the time everything's sold, I could maybe get $510 or $520. Then I'm going to have to spend $30,000 on stamp duty again to buy another place. So I'm going backwards. I've got to counteract these things, don't I?
Yeah. Oh, and that's where generally the rule of thumb is: if you don't need to sell a property, you know, don't, because the costs are hugely significant to get in and out. And again, that compares to, you know, buying the same share portfolio. You can probably do it for $30, you know, on a share trade.
What sort of money is involved in financial services? Like someone like yourselves, do you charge monthly, weekly? How does it work?
Depends on your situation. So you can come in and see us, and there's no cost there, just to come in for an initial appointment, and then we can go through some different options. Sometimes it's like a one-off cost if there's one thing that we need to do. But if it's an ongoing relationship, there can be a monthly charge if we're investing some funds for you as well.
Oh, cool. Thanks very much for your help. I'll get the number, and then at the end of the hour, and we'll definitely give you a call. Thanks, Michael.
Well done, Peter. That's fine. Now, you just stay listening. I'll give the number out in just a second. There's a reasonable dilemma to have, isn't it? But isn't it the case that most people really need to make their money in property when they sell it?
Yes.
And you see most people doing that around retirement, I guess.
Yeah.
And
cash in.
And delaying it until often the financial year after you've retired, because then your income's much lower and you can minimise the capital gains tax that you're paying when you sell the property.
You guys are the experts, I'm the novice with all this, but with all of this talk around, particularly from Labor, about capital gains tax on the one hand and negative gearing on the other, wouldn't know what the crunching of the numbers would be, but would it maybe be a reasonable policy to say, look, if we want to encourage more new properties, we'll limit the negative gearing to the new properties, but in exchange for that, we'll increase the amount that you can claim in capital gains when you sell it?
There's so many trade-offs. And, I mean, to be honest, that kind of scenario, I can't even think through all the implications off the top of my head.
$multi-billion. Mm.
Yeah. And it's not even just to do with property, because if you change the rules with one asset class like that, you then say, well, why can I then do the same thing with a share portfolio or whatever other thing that you're investing in? Because you can't really, you know, limit negative gearing on one asset class and then allow it on the other. It needs to be a blanket rule, I think.
Mm. So complicated. Ted. G'day, Ted.
Good evening, Michael. How are you?
Well, mate, thank you.
Listen, mate, I think these gentlemen here, I'd like to just thank them in a way, because I want to know if I'm on the right thinking when I state this here, that they're building a lot from Parramatta, Westmead, Wentworthville, Pendle Hill, Toongabby, Seven Hills. They're building thousands of apartment houses.
Mm.
And I just think, is this part, could this be part of what these people are going to invest in? And also, the population went to 24 million. They say it's going to jump to something else. And that's all okay, but the infrastructure is terrible. Mm. But that's another question, the terrible. But is that the reason they're building all these thousands of apartments, that these investors will be able to do this sort of thing too? I'm a layman. Yeah. I'm terribly sorry to be uneducated. I'm older than that and all this. But is that the right? Am I on the right track believing that?
Well, it seems like they're taking advantage of the interest in property at the moment from people buying it through super. So when there's that around, and it's also there's cheap money around it as well with the interest rates, people are going to buy into the properties, and there will be a stage where there is an oversupply. We don't know when or how when that's going to be. So, and then you'll start seeing the properties flatlining or potentially going down, especially all those, there's a lot of units being built as well. So it's hard to say when it's going to happen or what's going to happen, but there's a lot of people still thinking they can make money out of it at the moment.
Yeah, we were just talking about it off air, saying, you know, about the economy, and it all looks pretty good because you see all these cranes around building, you know, new developments. But, you know, the same thing happened in Ireland before the global financial crisis. You know, there's huge development. Everyone was getting into property and making a lot of money. And then just the normal forces of supply and demand, there weren't enough people to live in these properties, and all the, you know, all the values went down, and they're often now worth less than what people paid for them 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, that's right. That answers another question that I was thinking about. But they're all built near railway stations, and the infrastructure just can't cope with anything now, let alone with all these others. But anyway, that's only my little. Thank you for straightening it out for me. I believe that I'm on the right thinking. And thanks, Michael, for taking the call.
No worries, Ted. Good to hear from you, mate. Thanks so much for the call. 131873. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more questions and topics in just a sec. Let's start with the team from IT Financial Services. Did you know with IT Financial Services, you can look forward to a brighter financial future? IT Financial Services works with you in partnership to help you achieve your goals and to secure your financial future. Over almost 30 years, their advisors have helped thousands of people from all walks of life with everything from superannuation and investments to insurances and debt management. And it's never too early to start your financial journey. Just make one call to IT Financial Services. The number, 9258 7500. That's 9258 7500. Or visit their website at itfs.com.au to get started. IT Financial Services is Australia's own high-quality financial planning company. The number, 9258 7500. And from IT, I'm joined by Philip and Chris in the studio. Guys, we've got a call here from George, if the computer works. Yes, it does. Hello, George.
Hello, Michael. And the answer to your question is, yes, I did know IT Financial Services could help me with my financial needs.
Well, that's why you're calling, George.
This is not a setup, no. Hey, guys. Just a couple of related questions. You kind of touched upon it before, the first one. With negative gearing, however long it lasts, it can be applied, as Stephen Chobo, the new Minister for Trade, actually mentioned on Q&A tonight, to all asset classes. And I had somebody, a friend of mine, ask me about this, about people investing on the share market, buying shares through negative gearing, I don't think borrowing money and then using negative gearing. And I even heard about people buying taxi plates and things like that. So I just wanted to get, firstly, your opinion on what you thought about in the current situation. Obviously, we don't know how long negative gearing is going to last, but obviously you can take advantage of it while it does. But with the share market being so volatile, does it make any sense at all about investing that way in the share market? And what difficulties are there as opposed to property, where I imagine you get a, you know, steady, reliable income and you kind of know where you are? But with shares, you know, you've got a, maybe a once or even twice a year dividend. And then you've got to worry about the franking credits, if there are any, which is my second question. I'll just ask it now. With the franking credits, obviously there's a lot of companies now, particularly big companies, that are under the microscope from the Australian Tax Office about possibly paying back their tax. So what happens with people's dividends then if they actually, the company has a tax liability then that hasn't been paid? Do you get a little nasty thing in the mail saying we need you to pay back some of the dividend to us so we can pay the tax office?
You must be referring to Crown, which I saw in the news today. I think they have to pay back, what, $200 or $300 million in back taxes going back to 2009.
250, I think.
So, no, I think the dividends are paid. They're not going to be clawed back in that scenario. But existing investors, you know, the company would have to come up with the cash from somewhere, and that could then make it very difficult for Crown to pay its normal dividend. Mm-hmm. So and you'd expect that would cause the share price to fall. Although with Crown, I noted they are going to challenge it.
You're going to fight it, yeah.
Yep. So, but to answer your question about, you know, borrowing money to invest in shares and does it make sense? I mean, it makes as much sense as doing it into shares, I guess, as with property. And like I mentioned before, you know, the share market might be paying a gross dividend of something like 6.5% at the moment. So if you can borrow money against your home at 4 to 5%, and yet the shares are paying you, you know, I guess a gross dividend well above that, it's almost looking after itself from day one, so long as you can stomach the ups and downs along the way.
You need to find that growth over the longer term. So you need to be prepared to be in it for quite a few years to make sure, because, you know, the market could go down another 10%, but then it could go up 10% over the next 6 months. No one knows where it's going to head, but generally it trends upwards. So, but you've got to be able to cope with those negatives.
And the main difference between borrowing to buy shares is that, look, if you own your own home and you've got equity in your home that you could borrow against, then, you know, a bank will lend you that money just at normal home loan rates. But there's also loans called margin loans where you may not actually, let's say you don't own a home, you don't have property that you can borrow against, but you've got $1,000 in your bank account. You could go to a margin lender and say, look, I've got $1,000, and they'll say, sure, we'll lend you another $1,000 against that to go and buy whatever shares that you want to go and purchase. The risk with that, I guess, is that a margin loan is generally more expensive. You'll pay a higher interest rate. And then also, if the value of the shares fall, the margin lender can come back to you and say, you know what, you originally, you know, put in $1 and borrowed $1. Now that's all out of whack. We want you to put in a bit more money to increase your equity in the investment once again. So that's where you see a lot of people during a downturn who've borrowed too much get into a lot of hot water. So
that's the infamous margin call, isn't it?
That's it. So look, by and large in our business, I like to steer clear of them personally. But look, for some people who just can't afford to invest in any other way and who are wanting to gear up while the share market's down, it's one way you can get in and, I guess, not miss out and try and create some wealth.
Yeah, well, I suppose the idea would be obviously to wait for a share market crash and then buy in at the bottom.
Yeah.
But obviously property is a little more sleep safe at night kind of investment. Maybe the returns wouldn't be as great. So that's the balance, I suppose, you've got to make.
Well, and you've got to make a much bigger commitment, because to buy the property, you might have to put $500,000 to $1 million in Sydney, whereas with the shares, like I said, you could do it with $1,000. So you can do it at a much different level. So I've seen a lot of younger people do that, where they come to me and they say, look, I'm just not ready to buy a property now. You know, I don't have enough income, or I don't want the commitment, but you know what? I want to get started. I want to start a portfolio. How can I do it? And yeah, with as little as $1,000, they could set something up. And if nothing else, they at least learn the ropes. You know, they see how investment markets work. They get used to it. They start to understand it. And it's a great education.
And what kind of rate would you get a marginal loan for these days? How far above the regular loan rates would it be?
For a margin loan, it's usually 2 or 3% above the mortgage rates.
Yeah, it's getting a bit much, probably.
Yeah.
Environment, isn't it?
If you can use your money from your home loan, that's a line of credit. That's the best way of doing it.
Mm. All right, thanks, guys.
All right, George, well done. Thank you for the call. Much appreciated. 131873, any questions for the team from IT Financial Services about your finance or finance in general? 131873. Now, death taxes. Gee, this is a popular topic, isn't it? Tim Costello suggested this earlier, or late last week, I believe. Of course, Peter would have fallen off his armchair when old brother Tim got going. But I suppose the point is how to avoid it for your beneficiaries, if this indeed ever becomes policy.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's a popular topic or an unpopular topic.
Yeah. Well, those who it affects don't often call up about it, but
yeah,
they had their chance.
Well, Tim Costello was saying assets, or family assets over $5 million, so wouldn't be a huge amount of people it affects in Australia. But they're saying it's in the UK, if it's over £325,000, yeah, you're paying 40% in death taxes.
And they've seen the complete breakup and decimation of family estates because of this.
Yeah, exactly. And the US and Canada have got them. Japan, it's 55%. So Australia is one of the only countries that don't really have any official death duties.
Although we do have some, I guess, with superannuation. So the way the super system works is between spouses or dependent children, they inherit superannuation tax-free. However, if, for say, an adult child is to inherit your superannuation, then there are two components to your super, a taxable component and a tax-free component. Mm-hmm. And an adult child would pay tax at 15% plus Medicare levy on the taxable component. And that taxable component generally comprises, any contributions your employer has put in over the years. So I guess there is a death tax in that form. But there are ways around it now too, because, for example, if you knew you were particularly unwell, you could pull all your money out of super tax-free maybe, the day before you died and put it in your bank account, and then there is no tax to pay.
On that form of inheritance, there isn't, is that?
If it's not in the super system. Hmm. So if you take it out, you could avoid paying tax, or your beneficiaries could avoid paying tax. There's other ways as well that there's a chance that when you're over 60, when you can get into a pension, you can take your money all out of super and recontribute it back in. In some situations, you can do that, and they'll make it all tax-free. So when eventually it does pass on to your beneficiaries that could be taxable, that will become tax-free. And we've done a few clients, and it can save up to a couple hundred thousand dollars.
So
that
sort of out then back in policy, is that almost to flush it in that you, what once went in from say an employer's contribution, you take out and then you put it back in yourself, same money, but it's now your contribution, and technically it is null and void, the tax component.
Exactly.
Correct.
Right.
Right. And when can you do that? From 65?
From
the moment you can take all your super out.
Yeah. So when you read meet a condition of release, so it's when you can start drawing on an age pension or an allocated pension.
So 55 onwards at the moment, increasing to 60 depending on your date of birth.
Okay, and so there's no tax taking it out, and there's no tax putting it back in through that method?
After 60, there's no tax taking it out. No.
So basically you'd encourage everyone to do it?
Yeah, definitely.
How many people do it?
Most that see us, I guess, but...
Most people that don't see us haven't done it yet.
I was going to say, but without being offensive, most people don't see you, of course.
No, true. Yeah,
there's a lot of people out there.
But there are some catches as well, because a lot of people at retirement, as we've discussed, who might want to sell a property and get the proceeds into their super fund, and there are limits on how much you can get into your super fund each year. So sometimes that then precludes you from being able to do this withdrawal and recontribution, because there's other money you want to get in without exceeding your caps. So there are some trade-offs you have to weigh up.
And they're also floating in the budget. Possibly there might be lifetime caps on how much you can put into super and stuff like that. So this strategy could be at risk type of thing. So it might not be as beneficial for some people. So it's something that you want to act earlier on if you can.
Okay. All right. It's interesting. We'll take a break. We'll come back with more calls. 131873 is the number. Financial services, well, for the next 16 minutes and 20 seconds. So if you have any questions to do with your personal finance, now's a very good time to give them a call and take advantage of them being here and their expertise. 131873 is our number. Of course, Philip Tafe and Chris Malicki here from IT Financial Services. Gentlemen, regarding reverse mortgages, a lot of people have heard about these in one form or the other. They're very interested in this kind of thing. But how do you use your house to help fund your retirement?
Yeah, so a reverse mortgage is using your house or the equity within your house to help fund your retirement. So it's being able to release some of that capital that's locked in your house. You can get up to about 20% of the house value. I think you can start getting it when you're about 62.
Depending on your age how long they think you're going to live.
Exactly. So you can get it as a lump sum or a pension as well. So if your house is worth $1 million, you can get $200,000 lump sum. Or you can try and get a pension out of it, might get $10,000 a year over 20 years.
I think the point is it's a last resort generally. You wouldn't do it unless you'd spent all your other assets and money available to you. But I've seen it being extremely freeing for people who, you might be 70 or 80 years of age, you're down to your last dime, you're relying on the age pension fortnight to fortnight, and you know what? You just would really like $1,000 to be able to...
A better quality of life.
Yeah, just not have to worry about, you know, just being a few dollars short each fortnight.
And particularly, I suppose, if those medical bills start to come in.
Yeah,
exactly.
This is something that would affect...
So I've even seen it with my own relatives, you know, and it just means if they want to go interstate to visit family, they don't have to beg anybody for, you know, a couple hundred dollars to buy the ticket on the plane. They can just go and do it. And what is the downside? Well, I guess their beneficiaries are going to inherit a few thousand dollars less at the end of the day. Yeah. But that's probably a pretty good price to pay for some of that freedom. So used the right way, I see it as a fantastic development.
And the wrong way is what? How do you use this the wrong way?
I guess really to fund a lifestyle that's not sustainable. So, you know, you want to stay in your home, you really can't afford to, you're overspending, so you borrow the maximum that Chris mentioned, and then I guess you run out of options from there, and you've eaten up the value of your home, and where do you go from there? Well,
so this is something that has to be paced carefully.
Yes.
Yes.
If it's to be effective.
You want to do a good budget, work out how much are you short on a regular basis, and just draw that out as needed.
Okay, let's grab some more calls here, guys. Jane's on the phone. Hi, Jane.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Can I please ask you to rework something you've just mentioned? I just caught the tail end of it. You said that if you've got your money in a super fund, you would pay tax on it. But if you knew you were going to die tomorrow, you would store it all and stick it into a bank account. That way you don't pay tax on it. Exactly what did you mean by that?
Yeah, run through that again. I think a lot of people would have got half of that one, so yes.
So the things you need to have a look at, you'd need to talk to your super fund and you'd need to ask them, what's my taxable component and what's my tax-free component?
It's my own super fund.
Again, that doesn't really tell you what the components would be because it depends on how those contributions were made in years gone by. Mm-hmm. And it would be reported behind the scenes in the accounts of your super fund. Mm-hmm. And you'd have those two components. So once you know that, you'd be able to quantify, you know, if something were to happen to you, what would the tax be payable by your beneficiaries? And then you could work out whether it's worthwhile considering doing this kind of strategy.
Okay, because if you know you're going to die, you are looking at your beneficiaries, and I just assumed that whatever the source of the fund is to the beneficiaries, it'll be taxable in the receiver's hands.
Depends on the beneficiary. So if it was a spouse, an ex-spouse, a minor third child...
Party? A third-party non-family?
No, so third-party, non-family, they would be liable for tax on the taxable component.
Same as an adult child as well.
Taxable at either the company rate or the personal rate?
It's at 15% plus Medicare.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jane, for the call. 131873, lots of calls here. Mark, good morning.
Good morning, hi.
Well, mate, you've got Chris and Philip here.
G'day, Chris. G'day, Philip. Things all right?
How are you? Good, thanks.
Yeah, not bad, not bad. I want to build a granny flat at the back of my place, and last time I checked in my super, I got about 75,000 to 80,000 in there. Can I use my super to fund my building my granny flat at the back?
I think you've got a couple of problems to consider there. One is that you can't get any personal benefit or use from investments inside your super fund. So, you know, there'd be no relative that could live in it or anything like that if your super fund was to do that. It needs to be purely investment purposes.
And the granny flat's going to be on one title in your home on your block of land. So there's a lot of issues there. It would be very, very tough to get it through, I'd say.
And issue number two would be, even if you could do it, you know, 75,000 in a self-managed super fund is actually not a lot. We normally use a rule of thumb, you want to have about 300,000 in your super fund before a self-managed fund becomes a cost-effective option to consider. So I would have thought you'd almost be sending yourself broke pretty quickly by doing that strategy.
Okay. So if I want to have a self-managed super fund, how do I go about doing it?
Yeah, you usually speak to an accountant or a financial planner, and they'll help set one up for you as well.
All right, gotcha. But you advise against building a flat with $75,000?
Yeah, not with your super. And if it was your own money, or if you maybe if you could take the money out of super tax free, if you're over 60, maybe it's a possibility. But doing it in super, I don't think it's possible.
Okay, thank you so much, boys.
Not a problem.
Thanks, Mark, for the call. Good idea to call and get some advice. 131-873 if you want to do that as well. Good morning, Paul.
Yeah, look, a specific question. A person over the age of 65 that has that's still working and has superannuation with about, I don't know, $15,000 in it and a death component of $8,000 in it. Mm-hmm. What should they do with it?
And you're retired? You mean not working or...?
Thinking of retiring.
So, I mean, normally what people do, forget the numbers, you know, you're 65, you can start up an income stream or a pension from that super fund, and then the benefit of that is that the investments inside your pension fund, there's no tax. So there's no tax on the income, no tax on the capital gains that you make. So if you're still working, that's probably going to give you a better tax outcome. But if you stopped working and you didn't have much in the way of other assets, you know, you could almost pull that money out tax-free and put it in your bank account and not have to worry.
Sometimes the fees with super, yeah, they can be expensive, so it might be worthwhile taking it out. There is some cases where I've seen where we've just taken the super out. It's not worth keeping an account open with a small balance.
Can I ask an additional question, as in, if I die, what do my beneficiaries get?
With your, they'd get your super and potentially that death benefit as well. So
just the whole business. What does the beneficiaries of my will get?
So that's a good point. Superannuation is what's called a non-estate asset. So it really doesn't matter what your will says. You need to tell your super fund what you want to happen with those funds. So if it was to go to, you know, a spouse or a child, you could nominate them directly with the super fund, and then the super fund would pay the money directly, you know, to that beneficiary without having to go via your estate or your will. However, you can nominate your estate. Often on the paperwork, that's called your legal personal representative, which would be the executor of your estate. And then the will would govern how it is, how it's paid out, and the tax implications would depend on who those beneficiaries are.
Okay. Now, does the death benefit and what's in the fund get paid, or is it one or the other?
No, it'd be both of them. It's usually the super balance plus the death benefit because you're paying for an insurance premium there.
I mean, you just have to check with the insurance how long it lasts, because if you often there are cut-off dates. You know, you hit 65 and the life insurance runs out because they, you know, they know you're getting closer to that age where they'd have to pay out, so they just won't insure you anymore, or they ramp up the cost.
Well, why do they keep if you turn 65? And you're still working, and you're in a productivity fund, why do they keep the death cover component going?
Well, that's your choice. So, you know, you've had it in place. So long as you keep paying the premiums, it probably stays in force until you hit that age where the insurance cuts out. But if you didn't want the insurance or didn't need it, you could tell the super fund to cancel it, and then they'll stop charging you for it out of your fund.
Oh, okay. Look, thank you very much for your help. You're a gentleman and a scholar. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Paul. Well, you both are, in fact. Yeah. Paul, very good questions. That's an interesting thing Paul's talking about there that you raised as well, Philip, regarding superannuation and beneficiaries in wills, because a lot of people would assume, oh, I just write in the will and it's my husband or my wife or my kids or whatever, get it. But you can specify with super, can't you? And a lot of people don't know that.
And it's a great planning mechanism because so many people these days have estates or wills that are challenged.
Mm.
So it's one of the few, you know, mechanisms available to you to, I guess, circumvent the will and say, you know, forget all that. I'm going to do this binding nomination, so there's no discretion in the hands of the trustees as to where it's paid. You know, I nominate my spouse or my child, and that's where it must go.
Because often it's a huge amount of money. It's often people's biggest financial pool.
Yeah, people should check their super statements to see if they've got a non-binding or a binding beneficiary on their super statement.
How easy is it for them to check that? I mean, it wouldn't be in big bold letters up the top, so how do they check?
It's usually in their super statement. It's got a section beneficiaries, but if it's not there and they haven't seen a super statement for a while, they can just phone up their super company and talk to them and ask them about the beneficiaries, and they'll usually send them out some paperwork, and you've got to do it properly. You've got to get it witnessed by two people and stuff like that, so to make it, you know, in there properly.
And worth getting some advice on who you can nominate as well, because I see so many people who say, yeah, I've given it to my sister. Yeah. And so, but you can't. Mm. So that would be invalid. The trustees would then have to pay it to your estate and go in accordance with your will.
You could try to leave it to your dog or your cat, but that isn't legally watertight, is it? Even if you've gone through the official process.
No, as we've mentioned, really the only people you can nominate directly are a spouse, an ex-spouse, a child, or someone who's financially dependent upon you, or someone who has an interdependency relationship with you, which would be kind of like, you know, I can't survive without you and vice versa. Mm. Other than that, you pay it to your estate and it gets distributed that way.
I saw a case years ago now. There was two guys at university sharing a flat, and one of them passed away tragically. But because he was sharing a flat, they weren't related at all, but he claimed on his super and his insurance that he got out of there because he had an interdependency relationship because they were sharing the rent, and he got awarded some of that super and of the insurance. Yeah,
would have been tax-free.
Yep, exactly.
I've seen it too with a carer, you know, these people cohabitating, they weren't in a relationship, but, you know, one kind of looked after the other in some way, and they were a legitimate beneficiary.
Fascinating stuff. We'll take a break back, and it can be daunting. That is, without IT Financial Services, they demystify financial jargon, provide clarity to your goals and aspirations, and will help you to develop your financial blueprint to work towards your lifestyle objectives. Now, from financial lifestyle coaching, financial risk profiling, strategies and investments, to real-life financial solutions. Just make one call. That's to IT Financial Services. Now, here's the number again. If you've got a pen and paper, jot it down. 9258-7500. That's 9258-7500. Or if you are tech-inclined, you can go online, itfs.com.au. IT Financial Services, Australia's own high-quality financial planning company. They could make a real difference to your financial future. IT Financial Services, that number again, 9258-7500. To both Chris and Philip, thank you very much for your company this morning.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Nice and busy, and we will be back, all of us, I suppose, at some point together next week, same time Tuesday next week.
Look forward to it.
Have a great week in the meantime.